folks, and welcome to Christ in Every Word, a podcast of the Concordia Bible Institute, housed on the beautiful campus of Concordia University, Wisconsin. This is your opportunity to read, mark, learn, and inwardly digest the sacred scriptures with Dr. John Seleska, Director Emeritus of the Bible Institute, and me, Dr. Brian Gurman, Assistant Professor of Theology here at the University and the current Director of the Concordia Bible Institute. Dr. Seleska has had a long career as a parish pastor, college, and seminary professor, and he's known for highlighting how central Christ is throughout the entire Bible. So it's an honor to be with him here in the podcast room and learn a little bit more about our book that we're studying right now, 1 Samuel. I believe we're on chapter 13 now.
Right. We're on chapter 13, and we need to emphasize again this whole idea of the messianic kingdom. And all of the kingdoms in the Old Testament, beginning here with Saul, and then comes, of course, the highlight, the peak of all of that with David, and the promise given to him that the Messiah would be born into his family. But all of these had failures of some sort. All of them failed to live up to the expectations which God would have of a ruler over his people. But all of them do look forward to and do foreshadow the one great king to come. And that's what we really need to focus on in the Old Testament, looking forward to and eventually, of course, being presented with the king as he did, in fact, come on that first Christmas and then did what he was expected to do, all of it portrayed in the sacrificial system and sacrifices in the Old Testament. He would become the utter, absolute, final sacrifice to end all the other offerings and sacrifices. That really is our job in the Old Testament, to make him as clear as possible and to present him as really the central figure in the Old Testament, although on the surface it may not seem that way. Now, let's just sort of review what we went through last time and then to pick it up at chapter 13. But in chapter 11, we have Nahash the Ammonite trying to enter into a covenant to put out the right eyes of the men of Jabesh-Gilead. You recall we went through that and that Saul was angered when he heard about that covenant, quotes. And he went to the rescue of the people there, in fact, won a glorious victory. And so at the end of that, he is reaffirmed as king, and there is great rejoicing and joy at that time. And Saul himself was a happy man, and I want to emphasize that because it's going to become very different for him toward the end of his life when he has disobeyed God's commands and he seems to have left the Lord entirely when he had relied on him. And we'll see that today also. He had relied on it, but at the end did not and was a very unhappy man. And we'll talk a little bit about that also when we get to those chapters. Then it takes us, of course, into chapter 12, where Samuel sort of emphasizes his integrity as a prophet, as a priest, as a judge among the people. He really had ruled well under God, and he really was God's representative to the people. But they had asked for a king. He was old, he says, and gray-headed. His sons, he doesn't say it, but it seems to be implied that his sons, Joel and Abiah, took bribes and perverted judgment. They certainly did not follow in the footsteps of their father, were undisciplined children, we might say. And so then he sort of asks the people questions about his own integrity and honesty as he had lived and ruled among them and brought the word of God to them. Had he taken anything of theirs, oxen, donkeys? Had he perverted judgment himself, taking bribes or oppressed the people or engaged in fraudulent activity? And they all responded, no, he had not. And then, in a sense, he put them on trial also. What was going to happen with them as a consequence of their request of a king? And toward the end of that little, we'll call it dialogue, which went on between Samuel and the people, he explained to them that even so, throughout their history, they had rebelled against God. God still thought of them as his people, took care of them as his people, had sent judges to deal with the enemies, but all of those, quote, saviors had failed. As we have indicated to you, none of them was satisfactory to lead permanently, continuously, and forever over his people. But nevertheless, he said, if you obey, if you serve, if you fear the Lord, then you'll do well and your king will continue. But if not, then both you and your king will be destroyed. And then to reaffirm it all, we mentioned that to put it something like this. He underscored it, emphasized it, with thunder and lightning and rain during the harvest. This frightened the people terribly, and they said, it wasn't bad enough for us to rebel, and our fathers had rebelled under Moses, but now, of course, we've rebelled in asking for a king. We've sinned, and then they ask Samuel to pray for them. And so he tells them not to be afraid, even though they had done evil. This was not a good thing to request a king. Yet he would be with them. And again, he encourages them to obey him. These people had a history of not obeying and of going off course somewhere, following something else. Baal and Ashtoreth, quotes, rulers or the gods of the Philistines and others, and forsaking the Lord, but they were his people, and the Lord would not forsake them according to his name, that is, for his name's sake, because he had a reputation. He had made a promise, and he was going to keep that promise. And I'm not going to cease to pray for you either. Samuel is still a very remarkable person. Most people might be very unhappy under these circumstances and tell them when they left good riddance, but he doesn't say that. He's ready to pray for them, and he encourages them again to obey. But if you don't, it'll be a disaster for both you and your king. That brings us then to chapter 13 by way of a little bit of background and to set the stage. And in chapter 13, then we have a problematic verse immediately, that very first verse. Now, the King James says, when Saul had ruled 1 year, and then after 2 years... But that's very difficult to quite understand what is the meaning of that 1 year and then on the second.
In the ESV, we just have Saul was dot, dot, dot.
Oh, really?
Saul was dot, dot, dot years old when he began to reign, and he reigned dot, 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 and 2 years over Israel.
So they're not going to wrestle with it.
They just left it blank.
Now, it's interesting, however, that in Acts chapter 13, there is that passage there where Paul goes through this history, and he says that Saul reigned 40 years. Now, some of the translators said he started ruling when he was 30. That's how they read it here from maybe the Septuagint. I'm not real sure where it is. Of course, that would have been a lot later, and I don't know where those translators would have gotten that information either. But and then he ruled for 42 years. He was 32, and then he ruled for 42 years. Well, that's in conflict with the Acts passage. So, but suffice it to say, this is not easy to understand. But now he is reigning, and it says there, I think in the very first verse, it says that he gathered to himself 3,000 men,
right,
2,000 under him. Is it at Michmash? That and then 1,000 under Jonathan.
Correct. Right.
So Jonathan was his captain, I guess we would have to say, at this point. Now we'll come across the name Abner later on, and Abner was a very important figure in Saul's kingdom. But at the moment, at least, it seems to be that Jonathan is quite important. He had the 1,000 men, and then right away, I think in verse 3, it says that Jonathan won an important victory over a garrison of the Philistines. Mm-hmm. Just that. Not told anymore. Except that after winning this victory, of course, the Philistines heard of it, naturally, and naturally began to gather forces themselves to go to war against the Israelites. Now, I don't know, there must have been some interaction, because later we'll find that there were Hebrews among the Philistines when this next battle comes, when this big battle comes up, because the Philistines are going to want to do battle with the Israelites after what had happened with this garrison and Jonathan. But so that later on it says that the Hebrews abandoned the Philistines. Now, I don't know how to understand that, but hey, we haven't come to it yet. But it does make an impression on you about what the relationship initially must have been between Philistines and the Israelites. Were they mercenaries, those who had joined them? It's just not very clear, but it says that they were in the middle of them, and then they could begin to take up battle in that big battle, which will come in chapter 14. But there's a big battle that's going to come, and these Hebrews, I don't know why it calls them Hebrews, but it does say it in a couple of places here. Obviously, they were Jews. And I'm not sure exactly the meaning of it, except that they did fight, evidently, some of the battles against maybe some of the other enemies, the other tribes around, and were at some sort of peace. But after Jonathan, there's no more peace between the Israelites and the Philistines. And so the Philistines gather forces. Now, it's about verse 5 or 6 where it says that they have 30,000, am I right?
Yeah, that's right. 30,000 chariots. And 6,000 horsemen,
yeah.
And troops like the sand
like
of the sea.
Like the sand of the sea. Now, this is a big group of people. And obviously, the Israelites hear about it. And they're mortified. They're frightened to death. And continuing, it says that some of them even hid in holes and dens and caves from the Philistines. And now there's going to be a battle. I don't know. I have just no idea if seeing those forces against them, why Saul would even consider going to battle. I mean, you should sort of, if you see that the forces are against you to that great an extent, you kind of send an emissary to make peace, as Jesus said. Anybody would do that if he sees that the enemy is really much larger and that the chances of victory are very slight. But no, there's evidently going to be a battle. And now here is, of course, where Saul begins to fall. Now, some of the commentators say that there are as many as from 10, 20, 30 years that transpire between chapter 9 and chapter 13. Hmm. So we're talking, for the most part, if that's the case, about the last 10 years of his kingship, which is, of course, on that downward trend. But here now is this big issue. Saul, of course, is waiting and waiting. He had been told, evidently by God through Samuel, wait for 7 days. I'll come. I'll sacrifice. And this would be to kind of sanctify himself and his troops before going out into battle, setting them apart unto God, his people, his soldiers, his army. Well, Saul waited and waited, and as it says, some began to leave. They began to realize that the numbers and the odds are against us, and so they began to dwindle and dwindle. Saul saw this happening. Now, from any human perspective, any quotes, good leader would say, we got to start doing something, or I'm not going to have any army. There aren't going to be any people to fight for us. Well, at the moment that when he said, bring the sacrifice, the burnt offering and the peace offering, and he made the burnt offering, did the burnt offering, and who should show up? Samuel showed up. Now then.
Not long after, it seems like. He waited 7 days.
Yeah, he did wait.
The time that he was supposed to, but then...
time
what, 5 minutes
to,
later?
Just a little bit, little bit later. Then I don't know how he determined exactly. I mean, obviously, he probably hadn't waited the full time. But as far as he was concerned, it was. Saul was concerned. And so he goes out to greet him. And immediately Samuel says to him, what have you done? And so then, just as any human being, you can just see the humanity of Saul here. He makes excuses. When I saw that the army was beginning to dwindle, and you didn't come. What verse is that? About
11.
11, yeah. And you didn't come. We know whose fault it is.
Yeah.
It's almost as if he's saying, look, if you'd have been here, nothing would have happened. I wouldn't have done this.
Right.
You've sinned. And it's interesting. Now, I wonder if there hadn't been a kind of steady progression toward this point throughout these years. because it just seems almost too sudden.
Right.
He says, you disobeyed a command of the Lord. You should have obeyed. And it's obvious that Saul should have realized he's not a priest. He should not have commanded that the sacrifice be done. There's no way that he was in that kind of authority and should have taken that kind of position against a priest and against the Lord himself. It's almost as if I'm really on my own. In other words, this is just sort of an empty ritual. I wonder if he didn't think that way. A lot of people think of church services that way. I went to church.
Right.
I did my duty. Mm-hmm. What happened there was of no consequence. A lot of people are like that, and Saul, I think, is no different here. We all like that to an extent. I think if I did my duty and if I went to the Lord's Supper and went through all these motions, this whole ceremony, that should be enough to please God. So I'm doing what had to be done, and I think in a certain sense it had to be done. I had to sanctify this whole issue that was going to occur, and so I didn't want to attack without God's sanctions. I guess He wanted to be. This whole thing to be sanctified and in the eyes of the Lord, the correct thing to do. It's almost as if he's still spiritual to some extent. He didn't want to just rush into battle without the Lord's consent.
Right.
And yet, he had no, as far as he was concerned, he had no recourse. This had to happen. So he does it. But I wonder, as I said, if it hadn't been dwindling down to this point, if the spirituality in his life had been cooling off, because he did seem to be a very happy, quotes we would say, Christian man, mm-hmm. a godly man, sort of almost saintly initially, where he was with Saul also among the prophets.
Right.
But all of a sudden, boom, this is it.
Yeah.
The Lord's taken it away from him. Not only that, he's chosen someone already. A man, is, I don't know what passage, 14, 13, 14, a man after his own heart.
Mm-hmm.
Verse 13?
Yep, 14.
Mm-hmm. 14, yeah. A man after his own heart. Now we know who that is. But that had to be a shock to Saul. God's chosen someone else. I'm king.
Mm-hmm.
Now this had to cause kind of, what would you say, animosity on his part toward God. I'm king. He chose me. And at least it would be against that one whom God had chosen, a man after his own heart. There's going to be a lot of friction. We'll see that does happen.
Okay. Well, that might be a good place to take a break here. But that's a very interesting observation about Saul and where he is spiritually, especially after getting a pretty good start at first.
Yeah.
Defeated some Ammonites. And,
right,
and
right.
Things like that.
It all seemed to fit God's promotion of a king and his plan. It's evil to select a king. I'm with him, and I'm going to help him.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And Saul evidently realized that, and so ruled his kingdom under those circumstances, with that God leading. Well,
we'll pick it up with our friend Saul here and what happens after this on the other side of our break.
We'll be back in just a moment to the Concordia Bible Institute podcast. In the meantime, I'd like to have you consider this question. What is most important in higher education? How do you prioritize all the knowledge to be gained at an institution of higher learning? Concordia University, Wisconsin, located on the shores of Lake Michigan in Mequon, Wisconsin, just north of Milwaukee, is an institution that is committed to excellence in learning, but at the same time realizes that excellence in itself is insufficient without development in vocation. We believe that God works through our vocations, our callings, in order to serve the needs of those around us. The mission statement of Concordia University puts it this way: Concordia University, Wisconsin is a Lutheran higher education community committed to helping students develop in mind, body, and spirit for service to Christ in the church and the world. You can learn more about the over 70 programs offered at Concordia by visiting the website www.cuw.edu. And if you're benefiting from our Christ in Every Word podcasts, I encourage you to support this ministry by mentioning it to others and by offering your monetary support. Please consider supporting the Concordia Bible Institute by going to our website, www.concordiabible.org, and clicking on the contribute page. And now, back to the podcast.
we are back with our study of 1 Samuel chapter 13. Dr. Seleska has made some observations about Saul and where he was spiritually at this time. I was thinking about this a little bit as you were talking, and is this a little bit extreme, do you think, that, you know, Saul is, he made a mistake with this offering, but kings make mistakes all the time, right? David made a big blunder, and he seemed to stick with it and still found favor in the Lord's eyes, but here Saul does something that only the pastor should do, and the Lord seems to want to take the entire kingdom from him. Any thoughts on that?
That is, but it is fascinating. Except if you're going to be your own savior, in other words, if you're going to take over in God's place and do your own thing, now then, that's why I mentioned it. It does seem extreme at this point because we don't really have the preliminary history leading to this. If it's true that a lot of time has passed, when in fact. He probably had been diminishing in his relationship with God and his spirituality. We just don't know that. Mm-hmm. But it would make sense to figure that this seems awful, very sudden. Awfully sudden if you're the king and all of a sudden you make this what seems to us to be a little mistake. But to usurp the priesthood, to somehow attempt to suggest that what the priest does is not as significant as a lot of people think. I haven't noticed anything very much different. Saul might have said to himself, whether I do this or don't in the history of my leadership here, so what difference will it make? Although he says, I forced myself.
Yeah. I found that very interesting.
Yeah, I forced myself.
I saw the people. You know, the people are scattering, and you didn't come. And then, I forced myself. I didn't really want to. It wasn't really my fault.
All these circumstances just led me to believe this must be the right way. I don't know any other way. To us, it seems that way. But from God's perspective, he saw what was happening to Saul himself. We do know that this is not the real end for him. I mean, he could easily at this point have repented of what he did, what he had done, and thrown himself on the mercy of that Lord through Samuel and asked forgiveness, all that is implied in the sacrifice, could have done that. But he seems to begin to rebel more and more until suddenly at the end we see him go consult the Witch of Endor for information from the Lord. So it's clear he's falling.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe we could say here that the Lord intended for somehow Samuel to be able to speak a word of comfort to him. He's preaching law. And if Saul had recognized that this is the law, in a sense, and it had taken its proper effect, it would have brought him to, quotes, his senses. But we don't see that. Oh, we realize, of course, that God doesn't make mistakes. And so from a human perspective, however, you're right, it does just seem so sudden and so dramatic and drastic that it seems hard to understand why the Lord wouldn't have sort of warned him. Not that he hadn't before, I'm sure, but nevertheless.
Nevertheless, apparently, you know, he's not a man after the Lord's heart at this
anymore,
point. That's
no.
the thing, yeah.
No, and we have then, of course, the battle is going to occur, but we have, it's interesting, as preparations are made for that battle to come, there's a chunk of verses at the end which talks about how the Israelites were not armed. There was no blacksmith, so that they couldn't make swords and spears. Except for Saul and Jonathan, no one had a weapon of war, not a spear, not a sword. There were no blacksmiths. If they wanted to have their plowshares sharpened and the other instruments for farming, they had to go to the Philistines to have them filed and to have blacksmith sharpen them so that they would not be able to fight back. Now, it's very clear that if we think about that battle and the people dwindling and dwindling, it's almost like, with Gideon, you know, there aren't going to be enough people any longer. So he didn't really have the faith of a Gideon who let his army diminish until there were just a handful here. He could have done the same thing. Well, the Lord will take care of all of this. He doesn't really worry about it. As a matter of fact, we'll find that Jonathan does say that Jonathan is sort of a man after the Lord's own heart, because he will say to his armor bearer in chapter 14, the Lord can save by many or by few. Mm-hmm. And but it's evident that Saul didn't think that way. Mm. Now the battle is about to occur. Jonathan's going to start it, and we'll see what happens. That's chapter 14. Now, maybe you have some observations toward the end. Questions?
Yeah, well, maybe about this blacksmith thing. It seems to spend an awful lot of time on this blacksmith. There was no blacksmith to be found throughout all the land of Israel, for the Philistines said, lest the Hebrews make themselves swords or spears. But every one of the Israelites went down to the Philistines to sharpen his plowshare, his mattock, his axe, or his sickle. So is it the case, and then here are the prices for each, 2/3 of a shekel, 1/3 of a shekel. So it seems, is it correct to say then that the Philistines kind of cornered the market on the blacksmith industry? Did they have iron that Israel didn't, or they maybe were controlling?
Obviously the blacksmith would be the one who would shape it into whatever the form is they wanted, the plowshares and so forth. But it's obvious they were under the hand, the iron fist. of the Philistines, that the Philistines simply wouldn't permit this. And we know that it happened when the Israelites heard that the Philistines were gathering an army. They were petrified. Mm-hmm. We won't be able to fight against them. We don't have anybody who's battle-scarred, battle-toughened, and we don't have instruments of war. How could we fight against them? Mm-hmm. Which is, I guess, an indication of the amount of trust they had in that the Lord could save by many or by few, except for Jonathan and his armor-bearer. Both of them were more godly than, I guess, everybody else. But you would think somebody would make a file. Somebody would be able to do this surreptitiously, you know, without the knowledge of the Philistines. They would be secretly arming themselves, but evidently not. So that they would have to rely on the Lord's strength to do anything in battle against the enemy who lived in their midst among them.
Wow. Yeah.
But it is interesting, and I don't know. I don't know the mental aspect of it, the heart of the whole thing among the Israelites at this time. Had they left off to regard as of no importance to be independent and free under the Lord from the Philistines, their gods, and all that implied. It does seem to be a difficult period to understand in Israel's history. And having asked for a king, and we said that there may have been many years after Saul was chosen, that nothing happened in particular in terms of their relationship with the Philistines. And as I mentioned, it's almost as if some of them had really joined the Philistines and not only lived among them, but would fight for them, perhaps as mercenaries. I don't know what there were Hebrews among them.
Wow.
Well, anyway, we do have the armor bearer and Jonathan stealing away now. They know there's a garrison of the Philistines. And they leave. No one knows. It says that no one in the Israelite army knew.
Not even his father.
Not his father. And it's interesting the conversation that went on. Now, this is an interesting area also. There's evidently a divide there and sharp cliffs on both sides. Bozaz and Zena, they're given names. Zena means something like thorns. It's sort of like sharp, the other sharp, sharpened, bright, something like that. Bozaz, it means really shining, whatever. Nevertheless, they're given names, I think, according to their appearance. And it separated them, I know, at this point from the Philistines, but they're going to go across, or they want to go across. And they decide, the armor-bearer says to Jonathan, I'll do whatever you want. If you want to go up against them, I'll go with you. Now, it's a garrison and two guys. And so then they decide, it's interesting also, that they must have had some word. I don't know how they got this, or if they just decided that if the Philistines say, come on over, then we don't go over because this is, means that the Lord doesn't want us to go. But if they say, come on over and we'll show you a thing, which is in fact what they did say, then we'll go because the Lord has given them into our hand. If they say, we'll come, this is the right way. If they say, we'll come over, then we won't go because the Lord won't be with us. I don't know how they came up with that idea, but that's the idea which Jonathan says, and they agree to it. So they reveal themselves to the Philistines, and the Philistines say the quote's right thing. Come on over here and we'll show you a thing. So they do.
This come up to us, meaning that the Philistines had an advantage on top of the hill kind of thing? Come up to us?
That's, yeah.
In other words,
you know, I've often thought come up or to go up means really to be victorious.
For the Lord has given them into our hand.
If you go up, you're going up to a conquer and accomplish. That's the idea behind the going up. So I don't know. If the Philistines are speaking God's word here, he's telling us to go up. You're going to be victorious.
They say, come up, then we will go up. It's almost as if this is the opposite of what you would expect, maybe, that when they say, come up to us, the Philistines think, surely we'll have the advantage, we'll be able to, you know, king of the hill sort of thing, and yet that's precisely when the Lord kind of takes them in their trap, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah.
But that's an interesting...
Well, how they arrived at that, I don't know. Why did they think this was from the Lord? Evidently it was, because they agreed, this is from the Lord. He wants us to go up. Now, they do, two of them, against the garrison, which I don't understand, but nevertheless, they put them to rout. It says that that day they killed 20 men of that garrison in a small space, like I think the equivalent of 200-300 yards or something like that. In that small of a space, 200. And it's evidently confusion that creates this. They're running in all directions. And I just kind of picture it as the armor bearer and Jonathan go up. And they begin to fight, and of course the guys yell. I mean, the Philistines yell and scream and whatever you would do if it's, you're sort of surprised. Maybe it was that they didn't expect them to come from a certain position. It's just unclear. But nevertheless, they're put to rout. They yell, and of course they're put to confusion. And they begin to destroy one another. Hmm. Now there are... there are men of Saul who are watching this, scouts, if you will. And they notice it, and they call it to Saul's attention. Look, there's all sorts of confusion over there. There's fighting going on, and they're fighting one another. What happened? Saul says, count up the troops. Is there somebody missing here? So now, I don't know exactly how they did it. They must have had commanders of squadrons or something, but... He finally took the count, and sure enough, it was Jonathan and his armor bearer. They're not here. Oh, it's Jonathan who's creating all of this. And really, he won a great battle that day. I mean, who would have expected these two against all the Philistines?
Right.
So very, very interesting. Now then, it's going to continue. And during the course of this battle, as Saul... engaged. It's here that it mentions also that the Hebrews came out from among the Philistines and began to fight against the Philistines. So you can see the confusion which would reign among the Philistines, that here you've got the Hebrews who were, quotes, I guess, their friends initially, now fighting against them in their midst. It really would put the fear of God into them, and they would run in all directions. That kind of dramatic sort of victory that the Lord would win here just by using two men. Hmm. And nevertheless, so now Saul wants to defeat them to the very gory end, and he says, no one is to eat until I destroy the enemy. Hmm. Now, he puts them under a curse, an oath. That they were to swear not to eat. Well, Jonathan didn't hear it.
I'm just thinking that might be a good cliffhanger for a point to stop today.
We got to stop already.
Well,
okay.
There's quite a bit of
chapter
left, but...
Oh, there is. Oh, yeah, we wouldn't get done.
You're right, because there is this Saul's rash vow,
yeah,
as it's usually titled.
Yes.
He says, "Don't anybody eat anything until we finish the job."
Could it have been any dumber? I mean, you really think stupidity. These guys need all the strength they can get.
Right.
And, of course, Jonathan will show him. This really helps.
And his own son didn't hear.
Yeah.
And then...
It will help us to understand the depth to which he has fallen, because he's willing to put his son to death.
Yeah.
Well, this is really exciting, and we want our listeners tune in again next time.
To see what happens.
You want to know the story, the rest of the story.
Because after this...
You could read ahead, but don't.
That's right. You'll have to tune in for
yes.
that, right? Well, as always, thanks again, Dr. Sloska, for walking us through.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure. It's always fun to go through these stories and there's much more to come, much more gospel to come, because they're going to eat meat with blood in it, and there's a whole blood thing that has to be discovered.
Oh, yes. Good, good.
It'll be one of the highlights.
I look forward
to it. So you must come back.
Must tune in for that. All right. Well, that is all the time that we have for this session of Christ in Every Word. But please consider mentioning this podcast to your family and friends so that they, too, can learn more about God's Word with us. The mission of the Concordia Bible Institute is to provide Christ-centered Bible instruction from distinguished experts who teach Christ in every word of the Old and New Testaments to strengthen faith and spread belief in the one true God. Again, if you benefit from this podcast series, I encourage you to consider supporting the Bible Institute by going to our website, www.concordiabible.org. and clicking on our contribute page. I'd also like to point out that we'll be having a special one-day seminar on April 23rd with Dr. Robert Gagnon. He's considered by many to be the foremost traditionalist interpreter when it comes to the topic of the Bible and homosexual practice. Certainly a very timely issue these days. We're excited to have him. I encourage you to go to our website and consider joining us that day. Again, it's April 23rd, and you can find registration information on our website. Until next time, I'm Dr. Brian Gurman with Dr. John Sloska, wishing you God's blessings in Christ Jesus our Lord.